Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, our special colossal summer reading issue, so we've got a lot for you. Peter Keepnews tells us about the inside story of Animal House.
The characters that we are supposed to root for in Animal House are, in many ways, pretty reprehensible. They're drunks, they're destructive, they're abusive to women.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' Robin Finn looks at two new books, one about Bob Dylan, the other about Bruce Springsteen.
They were born geniuses, and I don't think the accumulation of money and the other trappings have slowed down what fuels that genius.
Also something unusual, peeks into the summer reading list of some of our colleagues at the Book Review and elsewhere at the New York Times. And Greg Coles has bestseller news.
Mr. Dorfman.
Hello.
0.2. Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son.
It's hard to believe it's been 34 years since those immortal words were spoken. Yes, Animal House was made in 1978. There's a new book about it called Fat, Drunk, and Stupid, the inside story behind the making of Animal House. It's reviewed for us this week by Peter Keepnews, an editor at the New York Times who also writes a lot for the Book Review and knows a great deal about comedy, and he's here to talk about it. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Sam.
So what does Matty Simmons have to tell us about Animal House that we didn't already know?
Well, unfortunately, not as much as I had hoped. I was very excited to read this book because Matty Simmons was the publisher of National Lampoon, and National Lampoon was the magazine that spawned Animal House. It sort of indirectly spawned Saturday Night Live also, because a lot of the people who were involved in Saturday Night Live from the beginning came from National Lampoon. Matty Simmons was the co-producer of Animal House, along with Ivan Reitman, who at that point was a virtually unknown producer from Canada, who later went on to become a director of movies such as Ghostbusters. Matty Simmons, therefore, is in a great position to tell us the inside story, which is, in fact, how this book is being promoted, the inside story of the making of Animal House. And he does have some interesting anecdotes, and he also did interview many of the people who were involved in the movie, behind the camera and in front of the camera. So it's a good little story. The unfortunate thing is that he doesn't really tell us a lot that you wouldn't already know if you, like me, were a devotee of this movie. There have been at least two television documentaries about the making of Animal House that's been discussed in other books, including a book about the National Lampoon that came out a few years ago called A Futile and Useless Gesture, I believe, is the name.
Peter, why the enduring fascination with this movie? There have been many great American comedies, you know, going back to the Marx Brothers and back to the silent era. How did this film, I mean, even when it was first released, it was so successful. I don't think many would have said, well, this is a landmark classic. Yet that's what it's become. How come?
It's hard to put your finger on it. And in fact, Matty Simmons isn't really able to, and I think some people have made kind of over-the-top claims about it. In this book, he quotes Ivan Reitman as saying that this movie single-handedly revolutionized American comedy because it brought a sensibility to the screen, a young, rebellious, I-don't-give-a-damn kind of sensibility that had never been seen in an American movie before. I don't think that's true, but I do think that it captured a certain kind of attitude that it was really the same attitude that Saturday Night Live had captured on television. I think there had been precedents for it. I mean, I think you can't say that it came out of the blue as far as what it was showing on the screen. It didn't break that many taboos that hadn't already been broken by people like Mel Brooks, for example, or in some underground films by people like Robert Downey Sr., or even the early films of Brian De Palma, which not a lot of people remember. But
which films are those?
Greetings and Hi Mom were the ones that sort of broke through for him. They were underground films. They were independently made and distributed, and they were very wild, anarchic, satirical comedies. But one of the things that makes Animal House different is that even though I think it really did carry on in the tradition of those earlier movies, it was a studio movie. It was made by Universal, a major Hollywood studio, and it had all the studio apparatus behind it, although Universal was the only studio that was even remotely interested in making it, and they were very cautious about it. They would only make it if the budget was kept very low and if the shooting schedule was kept to about a month. They were pushing pretty hard for there to be stars in the movie. One of the extraordinary things about Animal House is there are a few known actors or actors who were known at the time, notably Donald Sutherland, who had a memorable role as the pot-smoking English professor. John Vernon, who played the dean, he wasn't even that well known, but he was a journeyman who specialized in playing villains. But as far as all the principals, with the exception of John Belushi, who was known through Saturday Night Live, it was a bunch of young, eager actors. Many of them were roughly the same age as the characters they were portraying, which is pretty unusual, or was pretty unusual.
They were actually the college students.
They were not much older, and many of them had never made a movie before. Kevin Bacon, who a lot of people don't even remember, was in it. He played one of the evil fraternity boys from the villainous rival fraternity. He had never made a movie before. Karen Allen had never made a movie before. Stephen First, who played Flounder, the naive fat guy, he had never made a movie before. The director, too, was largely untested. John Landis, who went on to have a very distinguished career, his career was set back pretty seriously when he was shooting a segment for the Twilight Zone movie in which two people were killed, but prior to that, he was one of the hottest directors in Hollywood, and he was almost unknown. He had made one horror movie spoof that almost nobody saw, and he had done a movie called Kentucky Fried Movie, which was written by the same three people who would go on to make Airplane, but that hadn't even been released yet when he was chosen to direct Animal House. And according to Matty Simmons's book, Landis got the job only because nobody else wanted it.
Peter, is this a case where, all right, you do have these gifted, hungry young actors, and also in the case of a Landis director, but was there also a kind of chemistry and magic that occurred once they started filming it? So they play off each other, they discover things as they go, and all of this drives it, lifts it to a higher plane than it might have reached otherwise?
It seems clear that that's what happened. The script, which was written by two National Lampoon writers, one of whom was an editor, also Doug Kenny, and the other one, Chris Miller, had gone to college at Dartmouth and had been in a fraternity that was essentially the model for Delta House in the movie. And they were joined by Harold Ramis, who himself went on to become a very successful director, because they didn't know any better. They had written a treatment that was about 10 times as long as a treatment is supposed to be. They had virtually written the entire script. Everybody thinks of Animal House as a raunchy comedy, but apparently the original script was considerably more raunchy than what was shot. And the members of Delta House in the original version of the script were so out of control that they were almost indistinguishable from the bad guys. Simmons says that it was at his urging, and he also says it was at Landis's urging, that things were toned down a little bit. If you look at it in the context of comedies that are being made now, it's almost innocent. But if you look at it in the context of movies that that had come before. I mean, I've said there were exceptions. The characters that we are supposed to root for in Animal House are, in many ways, pretty reprehensible. They're drunks. They're destructive. They're abusive to women. They're so ill-behaved in some ways that I'm not sure that this movie could be made today. As influential as it's been, somebody would probably step up and ask that it be toned down.
So, Peter, when you mentioned that what we see on screen is actually more restrained than what was originally written, do we know what young people make of this film? Do they still find it funny, or are they offended by it? Or
I could only surmise. I don't recall ever talking to any young people about it, but it seems to still be a very popular movie. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, it does well on DVD and Blu-ray. It does well whenever it shows up on cable TV. It has an appeal that is kind of timeless. I mean, there are some things. There are some, the way the Deltas treat women might not pass muster in a script today. And there's one particular scene that was, it was very touch and go at the time, whether it was going to be cut or not. It's a scene that takes place in a black roadhouse where the Deltas and their dates end up. If you really look at it objectively, it's more about how dumb these white guys are to think that these black guys will accept them as their buddies because this band, Otis Day and the Knights, had played at their toga party. They end up being scared to death by these big black guys in the club. But it certainly could be interpreted as a little bit racist. And as Simmons says, that, you know, the studio really didn't want that scene in the movie. Now, what Simmons doesn't say, and I was surprised that he doesn't mention this because I have read this and heard this elsewhere, supposedly what led the Universal executives to decide that it was okay to leave that scene in is that they screened the movie for Richard Pryor. And they said, you know, does this scene in the Roadhouse offend you? And he said, hell no. It's funny. It just shows me that white guys are crazy. But I will give you an example of something that did not get into the movie. There's the famous scene at the end, the big insane climax when the Deltas disrupt this huge parade. And bear in mind that the movie takes place in 1962. There is a new frontier float with a big, like, papier-mâché head of JFK. And you just see it briefly, and there's no payoff. The payoff that was originally written, although never filmed, involved, I think I'm remembering this right, involved John Belushi taking a beer keg, throwing it at this float, and having it hit the head of JFK in exactly the same place where the bullet hit JFK's head in Dallas in 1963. And that was one of the places where the studio drew the line. They said a sight gag about the Kennedy assassination is not quite going to pass muster.
So that was never filmed at
that
all.
That was never filmed.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Peter Keep News, who reviews Fat, Drunk, and Stupid, the inside story behind the making of Animal House, in this week's book review. Toga! 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 Toga!
Toga! This is John Williams, the book's web producer at The New York Times. I asked a few people at the office this week to share a book or two they're planning to read this summer, and their answers appear throughout this week's podcast. As for me, I'm going to a relatively remote lake with some friends the week of July 4th, and I was planning to bring Stephen King's The Stand with me. I've never read King and thought it might be fun to see how many of the book's 1,400 pages I could get through in my brief time away. But a colleague, hearing about this plan, reminded me of Tim O'Brien's eerie novel In the Lake of the Woods. In that book, a Vietnam veteran loses a race for the U.S. Senate and then tries to solve the sudden disappearance of his wife in the Minnesota wilderness. I read it when it was published in 1994 and remember enjoying it. Revisiting its open-ended mystery might be an appropriately haunting lakeside experience.
Hi, this is J.D. Beersdorfer. I'm the production editor of the New York Times Book Review. This summer, I'm going to be reading about Winston Churchill, but in comic book form. Recently, I was up at the Morgan Library, and in the gift shop, they had this Winston Churchill, The Happy Warrior book, which is a collection of graphic novel, or I guess comics, if you will, about the life of Churchill that was published, I believe, in the Eagle comic over there in England. And so they've done this collection. There's some notes about it on the background, but they have reprinted a lot of the original comics. So that's what I'm going to be reading. Thank you, Morgan Library.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So round two in the Department of Justice, book publishers, and Amazon. What's the latest with all this?
Well, just to recap a little bit, last month in April was when the Department of Justice concluded its very lengthy investigation into the publishing industry and filed a lawsuit against five publishers, five of the major publishers, that is, and Apple, alleging that the companies had conspired to raise the price of ebooks.
Price fixing, antitrust, and it seemed odd at the time we talked about this because the publishers kind of seem like the little guys and Amazon the big monster. So what's happened next? What's going on in this round two?
So this week, two of the publishers that vowed to fight the lawsuit, and those publishers are Penguin Group and Macmillan. Apple, by the way, has also vowed to fight the lawsuit. But these two publishers issued their first formal and lengthy response in court to the Department of Justice.
All right, so they're fighting back, and what did they say?
Well, these are for court filings. This is pretty interesting reading. Both publishers, of course, strenuously deny that they engaged in any kind of illegal price fixing. But they go through and really go point by point and discuss what they did or did not do in response to what the Department of Justice says that they did. One example is that, if you recall from the original lawsuit, the government alleged that the five publishers that the government sued, the government said that they all were meeting in upscale restaurants in Manhattan in private rooms.
Oh, right. It had this kind of Judith Krantz novel feel to
yes.
it all. Yes.
And that, you know, the CEOs of all these companies were getting together and having dinner and discussing how they would align themselves with Apple and destroy Amazon and manage to fix prices throughout the industry. And those dinners came up in these court filings this week. Penguin Group refers to the dinners and says that John Makinson, who's the chief executive of Penguin Group and one of the, you know, alleged attendees of these dinners, Penguin said that he did host a social dinner on January 28th, 2009, but that it was only a dinner that was of social nature, that general book industry issues and trends were discussed at high levels of generality, and that Makinson followed antitrust legal advice and didn't discuss any issues relating to trade prices or confidential competitive matters. And Penguin also says that they did not engage in any kind of conspiracy over any kind of dinner. Macmillan says that John Sargent, its chief executive, quote, dined once or at most twice with peers from certain other publishing houses, but these dinners were social in nature. No conspiracy was hatched over any such dinner. So that was one of the more colorful things that these filings addressed. They also talked about the telephone conversations that the government referred to in its own lawsuit, saying that the CEOs of these publishers were calling each other and working out the details of how they would fix prices. And Macmillan addresses that and says that more than half of the telephone conversations that the government refers to lasted no more than a few seconds and were nothing more than missed calls.
So the government then it has really alleged a kind of classic behind closed doors conspiracy. And the publishers are saying they were just going about business as usual.
The publishers are saying, look, you know, we have dinner with each other. We know each other. One of the dinners was apparently to welcome Mark Ostola, the CEO of Random House, to the job when he came on in 2009. And the publishers also take the opportunity to fire at Amazon throughout these filings and make the point to the government and to anyone else who's reading these filings that perhaps the government should have been looking at Amazon instead. Penguin, in its 74-page response, called Amazon predatory. It said it's a monopolist that treats books as widgets. And it also said that Amazon, not Penguin itself, was the company that was engaging in anti-competitive behavior to the detriment of the industry. So both companies really tried to kind of redirect a lot of the criticism and point out what a lot of people in the publishing industry believe, which is that the actions of the book publishers helped, may have raised prices, but that they increased competition in the long run.
And Julie, how much is there a sense here that, all right, they're writing these legal documents, but they're also writing them for someone like you. They're writing them for journalists, for people who professionally follow this industry. And then they're sending a message to you as well that Amazon is the heavy here, not us, that there is a misunderstanding of how book publishing works, that people have these fantasies, you know, the three martini lunches and all of that, and it's held over for so many years. And so there's almost a kind of public relations aspect to what the publishers are doing here.
That's right. I mean, that's definitely one thing that's going on here. And keep in mind, this is technically still in the 60-day public comment period where authors, booksellers, anyone from the public is allowed to send a letter to the Department of Justice and say what they think about these lawsuits. Granted, we have no idea how much effect the public comment period will have, but we're still technically within that window. And if there is, if the lawsuit does move forward, which it seems like it is moving forward, you know, it could be a very long time before Penguin and Macmillan and Apple end up in court with the U.S. government.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Hello, this is Jason Stallman. I'm the deputy sports editor at the New York Times. And this summer, there are two books that probably won't leave my side. One is Country Driving by Peter Hessler, the former Beijing correspondent for the New Yorker. The book is a couple of years old, and I've been dying to finish it since it came out. So I hope to do that this summer. And also, I'll be spending a few weeks in London running our coverage of the Summer Olympics. So David Walachinsky's Complete Guide to the Olympics will be indispensable, 1,300 some pages of gold.
Hi, this is Jocelyn Gonzalez, producer of the Book Review podcast. I'm looking forward to reading one of these books that I bought on a trip to Iceland. It was recommended to me by a bookstore clerk in Reykjavik. It's called From the Mouth of the Whale by the poet and author Sjón. The book is set in 1635 Iceland, and it's about a healer who has been condemned to exile for heresy by the local townspeople that he lives with. Sjón's earlier book, The Blue Fox, is what got him recognition outside of Iceland, but he's also known for writing lyrics for the singer Björk. And actually, he was nominated for an Oscar for the song lyrics he wrote for the song I've Seen It All from the film Dancer in the Dark, which featured Björk in the lead role. Hopefully, Sjón's book will make up for the fact that I won't be riding horses near Reykjavik this summer.
Now, Bruce Springsteen's been around a long time. Bob Dylan's been around even longer. He just won the Medal of Freedom, was awarded with it by the president. There are two new books, one about each of these legends. The first is Who Is That Man? In Search of the Real Bob Dylan. It's by David Dalton. The second is Bruce Springsteen and the Promise of Rock and Roll by Mark Dolan. They're reviewed for us by a great reporter at the New York Times, Robin Finn, who's here to talk about them. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Okay. There has been a ton written, said, rumored, fantasized about Bob Dylan. Do we learn anything new here? Is this a book that tells us something?
I think it's a book that adds to the fascination of the man and does it in a humorous way. So I came away from this book impressed by the fact that Dalton is obviously a complete acolyte of this man, Dylan, and yet he's able to poke some holes in the myth where necessary, and he's also able to make Dylan come across almost human, which sometimes can be difficult when someone has been turned into such an iconic, mythical figure.
Well, let's start with some of the holes. What does he tell us?
Basically, he tells us that Dylan is whoever you want him to be. He's completely duplicitous. He's completely happy to be duplicitous. He loves not answering your questions directly. If you ask him, how do you like that movie? He will reply, who made this paneling? How can I get some? He turns out to be a guy that is not really living in this complete haze that you might have thought he was living in, but he certainly turns out to be an incredibly intelligent, odd, quirky, selfish, and humane figure.
Is he, all right, duplicitous with interviewers? Hey, you and I are both journalists, but we get it. We know that they don't want to hear from us all the time. Was Dylan, or is Dylan, duplicitous in more like disturbing ways too? Or that, I mean, does he mistreat the people around him, or anything like that?
I haven't heard that he's actually physically mistreated, but verbally, yes. He's been known to be very cruel, to dismissive to his associates, rude to women, but that hasn't seemed to inhibit him in any way from being chased by women, although these days I don't think they're probably chasing him. They probably chase his son, and not too long a time they'll probably be chasing his grandson, because he is, of course, a granddaddy of 71, even though he doesn't always act or look like one. And when he received that medal at the White House, he was wearing his shades.
I noticed. Yeah, well, once a rocker, always a rocker. What about the humane side of Dylan? I mean, this is one of the great artists of our time. We know he's a visionary and a poet, but are there different aspects of his humanity that Dalton illuminates?
I think what Dalton shows us about this person is that he deeply cares about the planet that he lives on, even if he doesn't always treat every other person on that planet with extreme sensitivity. At the bottom of it, I think he truly does care for people and the freedom that they should have to be themselves, and in essence to, whenever they can, do what he did, which is create his own myth, live his own myth, and exercise his incredible talent to the max. But he's also a nasty guy. But what genius isn't in a way? They because they are so focused on what their own mission is, and also the whole perfectionist thing, which we'll find in Springsteen too, who was saddled by the myth of being the next Bob Dylan.
All right, let's move on to Springsteen. Also, well documented life. Who is Mark Dolan, and did he get access to him? Did Springsteen talk to him, or was he also unapproachable in the way Dylan is?
Yeah, these are both biographies that are done by an incredibly well-documented researcher researching of the researchers who have written biographies in the past. So the bibliographies in these books are humongous, and the actual new quotes from either of these musicians are null and void. They're both compilations, and they're both compilations with an agenda, and you know, Mr. Dalton's was really just to explore the brain of Bob Dylan. That was what he was thinking of calling the book, Bob's Brain, until he thought better of it. The Dolan book is much more of trying to cite Springsteen in history. It's a sociological look at Springsteen and the forces that shaped him and the way that he was able to connect with a very massive audience.
What are some of the forces, Robin?
He talks, first of all, about war, politics. Springsteen, it took Springsteen a lot of time to actually come out and endorse a politician. And I think the first one he endorsed was Kerry.
John Kerry in 2004?
Mainly because Kerry endorsed him and took one of his songs and was running with it. But Springsteen has historically been identified with the working man and the working class and economic struggle. So he graduated from writing about teenagers running away from their swampland roots to talking about people living the blue-collar hard life and having to scrape by for everything that they get. And, of course, he's criticized because he hasn't lived a blue-collar life in quite a while. But that doesn't mean he doesn't empathize with those.
Robin, do we get a sense in either or both of these books of just how disciplined and dedicated these men are as creative artists? I mean, are they working a lot? Because what we think about is, well, you know, they're super rich and they live the most glamorous of lifestyles. Everybody wants to be them and beautiful women pursue them and all the rest. But how much actual time is spent either alone or with colleagues just being creative people? Do we get a sense of that?
We get a sense of it more in the Springsteen book, which is exhaustive in its researching of how he came up with this playlist, how he refined that playlist, who he brought in, why he brought them in.
You mean the musicians he brought into the band?
Yes, why he did whatever he did at that time. But both perfectionists and both obsessive, but particularly Springsteen in terms of re-recording, wanting things to be perfect, driving people around him nuts because he was such a perfectionist and wanted to make sure that the message he put out there was his message and not the record company's message.
And do we have a sense, too, that, you know, you probably remember the time, I certainly do, when we all thought, well, no one would play rock and roll music past the age of 30. Nobody would listen to it beyond that. And instead, here we have these figures who were, you know, been around a long time. And are they still driven by the same passion and enthusiasm for the work that they were when they started out, or are they just rich guys going through the motions?
I would say neither of them are rich guys going through the motions. Dylan certainly has slowed down a bit in recent years, and he seems to be, whereas in the past, I don't think he would show up at the White House and in his little black suit and be accepting awards that maybe when he was younger he might sneer at, or he would be, you know, busy up at the Big Pink writing songs in his basement or creating some other myth for himself. Certainly workaholics both. And Springsteen continues to be a workaholic and continues to refine his message in keeping with the times. And certainly our economic disaster has given him a rich fodder to build on. You can't deny the fact that he's a multimillionaire, no. But I think before he was a multimillionaire, he was an artist. I mean, these guys were both, they were born geniuses. And I don't think the accumulation of money and the other trappings have slowed down what fuels that genius in them.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
You're so welcome, Sam.
That's Robin Finn, who reviews two books in the summer reading issue of the Book Review, Who Is That Man? In Search of the Real Bob Dylan, and Bruce Springsteen and the Promise of Rock and Roll.
Hi, this is Jen McDonald. I'm a preview editor at the Book Review, and this summer I'm planning to read Stanley Karno's History in Our Image, America's Empire in the Philippines, which traces Philippine history from the 16th century through the Marcos era. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 1990. My father grew up in the Philippines but didn't talk much about the country's history when I was growing up, so this will be my attempt to fill in a bunch of gaps. It may not sound like beach reading, but I did a little search, and back in 1989, the Book Review included it on its list of vacation reading, so it's not a completely crazy idea.
Hi, I'm Hugo Lindgren. I'm the editor of the New York Times Magazine, and this summer I am focusing on blood and guts. One of our contributing writers, Peter DeYoung, has written a new novel called Buried on Avenue B, so I'm going to read that. I'm also going to reread the Hoke Mosley series by the incredibly excellent Charles Williford. He's one of the best crime novelists ever, and the Hoke Mosley series takes place in Miami. There was once a movie of one of them called Miami Blues, starring Alec Baldwin, quite an excellent movie. And I think I'm also going to read a Nick Cohn novel that I've never read called I'm Still the Greatest Johnny Angelo. Actually, it's I'm Still the Greatest Says Johnny Angelo. Nick Cohn is a great rock critic and wonderful writer, and that's been on my list for a while.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, not a lot. Over on the fiction side, there's just two new titles. The first of them is at number 8. It's Richard Ford's new novel, Canada, makes its debut on the list. That's his first novel in 6 years since he finished up his Frank Bascombe trilogy that started with The Sports Writer, and he won a Pulitzer Prize with Independence Day. And then he finished that trilogy with Lay of the Land 6 years ago and kind of retreated into silence. He switched publishers. He was publishing at a steady clip until then, and then suddenly there was nothing. And now he's come out with this new book.
Which is getting terrific reviews.
Well, that's what I was about to say. Yeah, it's really a return to subjects that he's written about before. It's coming of age story in part. It's the dissolution of a family in part. It's set entirely out west, but partly in Montana, and then it moves up to Saskatchewan. So it's a kind of a prairie story.
Good for him. He's really emerged as one of the major American novelists, hasn't he?
He really has. Yeah, he's had a long career now. He hasn't always been that well reviewed here at the Times. Larry McMurtry gave a negative review to his very first novel. Then the sports writer, Alice Hoffman, gave that a critical review, which Richard Ford responded to by going out in the back and shooting a hole through it with a gun and then mailing his copy of that to her. Then the other new title on the fiction list is a novel called Beautiful Sacrifice by a woman named Elizabeth Lowell about missing Mayan artifacts. It's an archaeologist thriller. Then on the nonfiction side of things, Edward Klein is still at number 1 with The Amateur, his anti-Obama book. The highest new book on the nonfiction side is Colin Powell's new memoir, It Worked for Me. It's kind of presented as a guidebook for effective leadership. Powell, of course, is the former Secretary of State, four-star general, very accomplished military and political figure. There's kind of folk wisdom in the way the book is presented. It's got chapter titles like Kindness Works and Trust Your People. But it's really getting a lot of attention because tucked in there is a sort of mea culpa for his speech to the United Nations back in 2003, making the case for weapons of mass destruction.
For the invasion of Iraq.
For the invasion of Iraq.
And also not just mea culpa, but also some darts tossed at former colleagues in the Bush administration.
That's right. He's a diplomat professionally and by nature, and so he's careful about this, and he accepts full responsibility for the speech, and he says this is the best intelligence that we had at the time, but it was flawed intelligence. And he's very clear in the book that he was not pleased with Dick Cheney's handling of the intelligence, that Cheney didn't hand it over to the proper channels to get put into a real analysis or assessment, that instead he handed it to Scooter Libby to have it built up as a legal case, arguing guilt or innocence instead of a disinterested analysis of the facts at hand.
And of course, this has been the great issue with intelligence gathering since the beginning. There were debates about this, whether it should be used for ideological or political purposes. Is one's goal as an intelligence gatherer to gain the information you need that will enable you to do what you want politically, or to assess in the most analytical, detached way, you know, the nature of threats and forces?
In some ways, it parallels the discussion about the role of the media. Should the media be advocating for one side or another? Should it be taking a kind of passionate partisan stance? Or should it be a disinterested observer just reporting the facts and letting its audience reach their own conclusions?
Anything else on the list?
Yes. Down at number 10, Peter D. Schiff is new on the list with a book called The Real Crash. Schiff is an investment broker, and he is frequently a guest on Fox News. In 2008, he was an economic advisor for the Ron Paul campaign. He takes a very limited view of the role of government. He argues for cutting the defense budget in half and still making that half of the national budget.
You mean reduce the defense budget by half and yet reduce the rest by even more?
Okay, so here's his argument. During the Kennedy administration, defense spending accounted for half of America's budget. Defense spending has grown, but the rest of the budget has grown so much that defense spending is now only 13% of the budget. He argues for slashing defense spending in half, making it just defense, not offense anymore, making it truly what we need to protect our borders, and then reducing everything else so much that even slashing it in half, that that defense is still half of the national budget. He would get rid of Medicare. He would get rid of Social Security. He would essentially take us back pre-New Deal, into the 19th century. And he argues that America should declare bankruptcy, the equivalent of a sovereign state declaring bankruptcy to free itself from its debts to other countries.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.